You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to this special episode of Meet the Farmers. I'll actually start with an apology to my regular listeners if you were hoping to hear from Tom Bradshaw, as I suggested in the last episode. The good news is that I will be speaking to Tom in a couple of weeks' time, and the episode will be available shortly after that. However, having just spent two incredible days in Oxford at the 9th Oxford Real Farming Conference, I had to put this special episode together, which provides a glimpse into my couple of days at Oxford Town Hall, which is where the event was based. As usual, there was a plethora of talks and debates on offer, and I cannot possibly do justice to all of it, so this podcast focuses on a few specific topic areas and speaker sessions. If you're new to the Meet the Farmers podcast, perhaps you attended the ORFC and found the podcast through that, welcome, and it's great to have you on board. You can listen to other episodes at thinkingcountry.com or on iTunes. Normally, I just speak to a single farmer per episode, which is why this one is slightly different. This was my third time at the ORFC, but it was just as exciting as the first a few years ago, and I want to thank the organisers for putting on what was quite simply a brilliant event. This year, there were four strands to the programme. One, farm practice, looking at new ideas and best practice in agroecological farming. Two, growing and supporting the next generation of farmers. Three, Brexit. And four, the big ideas, what truly needs to be changed to bring about what the ORFC terms an agrarian renaissance. An entire room was dedicated to Brexit, and indeed the first session in the main hall gave delegates an insight into the grave complexities behind it, albeit ably summarised and appraised by Sustain's Kath Delmeny. I caught up with Kath after the session and asked her about her take on the Brexit process so far.
I'm with Kath Delmeny, who has started the conference with a very comprehensive appraisal of the state of Brexit to date. Kath, Brexit has very much been your life for the last 18 months or so. But clearly there's still a lot of uncertainty.
There is absolutely lots of uncertainty. You've just attended that session. I put lots of visual aids on the stage to help people navigate. One of them was a big box with question marks all over it. Lots has not yet been decided, and this year everything's to play for. So I'd say that 2019 is a very important year for Brexit, particularly in relation to food, farming and fishing.
You mentioned during your session that there are still several big elephants in the room. Can you embellish on that?
Yeah, I even drew some pictures of elephants on the stage for people to kind of picture that there are some big things that have not been addressed and tend to get left out of conversations. So one of them is we're making lots of policy. We're bringing powers back to Westminster to govern our future food and farming. Well, Westminster is not Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. So what is the relationship with Northern Ireland? What is the relationship with Scotland? Farming policy, these are devolved matters. And quite rightly, those countries are saying, hang on a minute, we need a big say in that. And they're probably not getting as much a say as they should. The other big elephant in the room was trade deals. We will be talking a lot about high standards for farming, high standards for food. But we've already been told by the US head of commerce that if we want to go into a trade deal with America, we will need to accept American product standards. So however much we hold dear the idea of high standards, there will be huge fights over the next few years, starting around about now, about what those standards we will be able to defend. There seem to be two narratives at the moment. One is about high standards, British farming, helping British farmers to do well, look after the soil, look after the bees, look after their animals. Fantastic. The other narrative is about international trade deals. We are desperate to get into new international trade deals to prove that Brexit was worth it, but also to strike a new future.
Kath Delmeny there. Following a short break on the Thursday morning, all delegates gathered together in the main hall to listen to a Q&A session with the Secretary of State for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, the Right Honourable Michael Gove. The session was chaired by Zach Goldsmith, MP, and consisted of 20 minutes or so of questions from the chair and then 20 minutes of questions from the floor. Here's a taster of what Michael Gove had to say.
When we talk about cheap food, there are huge hidden costs in what we've come to think of as cheap food. Now, I don't want to bid up the price of any commodity simply for the sake of it. I recognise that there is poverty in this country and elsewhere that means that there are people who are who face a daily challenge in order to eat well. So I'm not talking about increasing the price of food for the sake of it, but I do think it's important that we all recognise that Food that is produced cheaply, often in other jurisdictions, is produced in a way which creates environmental costs and externalities. And also, cheap food of a particular kind creates health costs for the children and families who are consuming it, which food which is produced to higher standards is far less likely to do. So when we're thinking about cost, it's not enough simply to think about whether an individual meal prepared by a particular caterer is 95 pence or £1.10. It's also worth thinking about whether or not the food that we, in particular, are feeding children in school or are providing for people in hospital actually works to promote public health overall and comes from the right sources and is also presented in the most balanced and healthy way.
Research that is generated by DEFRA, I believe, recently published, shows that there's been a 10% drop in bird numbers since 2010, which is the year I was elected, a very short period of time, 10% reduction in the number of birds. That's clearly a direct consequence of the manner in which we treat our land. And part of that is associated with the use of chemicals, intensive use of chemicals. Is it part of your vision that we will be moving towards a more organic a means of producing food in this country? Is that, in your mind, an aspiration that your department, that the government, that the country should have?
I certainly think that we should move towards a more sustainable method of agriculture. I certainly think it's the case that the organic movement has done amazing work in which has influenced farming overall. I think it's difficult to prescribe that every farm should meet the, I think, wisely high standards that the Soil Association and others require before someone is badged as being fully organic. But I think that many more farmers would like to go down that route than currently do so, and part of the responsibility I have is making sure that public money can help them through the transition period before they become fully organic.
I've got so many issues to discuss. I want to talk about Brexit and trade.
Yes.
We will be required to, and we will want to, forge new trade agreements as we leave the European Union. There is concern, in fact, there's a report issued today by an all-party group on agroecology, that will require us to compromise in relation to our animal welfare standards, our environmental standards. We've heard talk about chlorinated chickens. You've given a very good answer to that in the past, a very reassuring answer in relation to hormones in our beef and our milk, in relation to GM food imports and so on. I suspect your position is probably a reflection of the position, if I can generalise, in this room. My concern relates to the tension between your department and others, not least the Department for International Trade. So how do we overcome those tensions? How can you reassure people in this room and beyond that we will not be compromising on the standards that we hold dear in this country? In fact, that we'll be moving those standards upwards.
I think there are two things I'd say. I think the first thing is that the future for British food production is in quality and in provenance and traceability and in consolidating the reputation that many people in this room have helped to build. The future for British food production is not a race to the bottom, it's competing at the top of the value chain. And if we sign trade deals or lower our regulation or welfare standards in a way that means that we're no longer confidently at the top of the value chain, then we undermine the growing strength of the very best in British food production. The second thing is that trade deals ultimately can bring all sorts of benefits, but they also bring challenges. But trade deals live or die on the basis by which a public are prepared to support those changes. So TTIP, whatever its strengths, whatever its defects, ran up against public opposition, both in the UK and the EU. If we were to secure a trade deal, for example, with the United States of America, and I believe it could bring many benefits, it is the case that some of the aspects of it which do cause concern to citizens here, I think would be unlikely to get through the House of Commons. And I think that there's a danger that those of us who do believe that free trade can bring many benefits would lose the argument to people who, for a variety of different reasons, are sceptical of those benefits if we as free traders found that we were using free trade as a Trojan horse for the lowering of particular standards. People would quite rightly say that that was not what trade and exchange should bring, that the maintenance of high standards is a precondition of proceeding with trade agreements.
To listen to the whole Q&A session with the Secretary of State, the RFC have made the audio recording available, and you can find it on SoundCloud. I'll add the link below. If you're listening on iTunes, visit thinkingcountry.com and search for Meet the Farmers episode 13, or go direct to SoundCloud. Directly after Michael Gove and Zach Goldsmith left the stage, I sat down with Nessie Reed, Miles King and Vicky Hurd to debrief what he had said.
We've just been listening to the Right Honourable Michael Gove. This is the first time that a Secretary of State for DEFRA has actually attended the Oxford Real Farming Conference. And I'm joined now to debrief the session with Nessie Reed, the Programme Manager, ORFC, Vicky Hurd from Sustain, and Miles King from People Need Nature. Thank you so much for speaking to me, everyone. Nessie, could you start by drawing out some of the key points that Mr. Gove was talking about?
Absolutely. I think a lot was covered, and in quite a bit of depth, but of course we only had 20 minutes for Q&A, so we couldn't go into full detail. But some of the things that came up for me, he talked quite a lot about cheap food and the true cost accounting within cheap food, so talking about the externalities, both for labour, both for the environmental costs. That's something I'm deeply passionate about in my own work, so I was really glad that he mentioned that. Also, he talked quite a lot about an awareness of biodiversity and increasing biodiversity on farms, and also a little bit about soil health. I was really glad those were touched on, as well as prioritising for small farmers a bit more and for those who actually steward the land rather than just landowners. I work and live on a small farm, and it's incredibly difficult to extract a living. And so often the people who actually look after land the most aren't really considered. So I was really happy that was mentioned. Also, Zach talked a little bit about how in the Richmond borough, how they've actually changed the school menu to be, I think it's either completely organic or local. So it's essentially a much more of a sustainable menu within schools. And it's actually become much cheaper, which is against what most people think, that if you choose organic and local, it's more expensive. It's actually really proved in Zach's borough that that's not the case, which was really inspiring and a case study I'm going to look at. The things I was a little bit disappointed about was that there wasn't much of a push from Michael Gove about organic, and I feel like he shied away from it, and I really do believe that we need to keep moving towards a completely organic system.
Miles, perhaps particularly from a nature and environment point of view,
yeah.
Was there anything that Mr. Gove said that was a particular cause for optimism or a particular cause for concern?
I think he's taken up the mantra of public payments for public goods. And as far as I can see, he's saying that more or less every time he talks about the future of farm support in the UK, which is fantastic. You know, it's what we've been arguing for many years. And to my mind, that is a very significant shift in government thinking. One thing that actually Zach Goldsmith questioned him on was in relation to his views on neonicotinoids as opposed to glyphosate, and Secretary of State explained that he felt the science had moved to a point where there was no question that neonicotinoids should be being phased out, whereas for glyphosate, the science was still up for debate, and he had been persuaded by the zero-till lobby that glyphosate was an essential tool for them, and thereby he seemed to give the impression that zero-till with glyphosate was the kind of agriculture which was delivering public goods in terms of soil quality. That was something which I felt he was probably giving conventional agriculture, albeit a new version of it, a pass for public goods.
Is he trying to do all things for all people, in your view?
No, I don't think he is. I think it would have been very interesting to have been at the OFC this morning to gauge the response of the industry to what he's proposing. I read his speech to the OFC in advance, so it was clear what he was saying, and he didn't differ between what he said to them and what he said to us. I would imagine that there would be a lot of people in conventional farming who would be deeply worried about what's being proposed, because they can see, A, they're going to get their payments capped in the pretty near future, and B, after the transition period, there'll be no direct payments. It'll all be for public goods. And I think that's going to cause a big shift in thinking, and I think that's already happening. So, in response to your question, I think he is, to a certain extent, saying to us he thinks we want to hear, up to a point.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't going to say, oh, yes, I'll change the grocery code adjudicator to whatever you want, Vicky.
Yeah, specifics. Yeah. He was very clear.
He was pretty clear. I think he thinks he's pretty clear about where he wants to go. Now, of course, my question in relation to the non-monetizable elements of public goods, of which there are a great deal, and he actually referred to them in his speech this morning, he didn't really give me an answer. He kind of explained why he felt he needed to use the language of natural capital when talking to people in the Treasury. I think that was the merchant banker analogy. But it doesn't actually answer the question, how do you incorporate those things into a natural capital framework? And that they still have got to do that thinking. But overall, I think direction of travel is very promising.
Yeah. And Vicky, what does Mr. Gove need to do now to prove his words, to prove himself?
Well, how exciting to hear him say that he has already been talking to the Department of Health. Number one thing I think he really should be doing is going talking to Public Health, Department of Health, and getting some really clear steer on both procurement and the benefits of better food in procurement, but also the wider changes that need to happen with regards to supporting farming. So we get more fruit and veg, we reduce toxic load, etc., etc. So that was really exciting. I think the other thing, he got a very good level of support here. You know, and I think he needs to build on that with a really good consultation through the command paper, which is in advance of the agriculture paper. So that consultation needs to be genuine. Let's really listen to people, listen to the members of the public, listen to small farmers as well as big farmers, not just the representative bodies. Genuinely go, get DEFRA out there, having a proper consultation and listening. And what was exciting was how the range of public goods that Secretary of State is talking about. And I find that encouraging, and he was talking about today both conferences. But he needs to deliver some interesting ideas on that, so he needs to listen to people. And one of those would be his commitment to smaller farms and farm diversity and new entrants, which he touched upon, but we've yet to see some concrete policy ideas. And there's a lot in this room that he needs to listen to and take on board. So delivering on that, delivering on the procurement enthusiasm, he said, for getting procurement to create a market for sustainable UK producers and also deliver healthy produce for schools and hospitals. That's very exciting. And I think what happens with the grocery code adjudicator, we're still waiting to hear. He didn't give me an answer I wanted to hear. He said, not as exciting as we want, which is disappointing because we definitely know there are unfair trading practices in the supply chain that need to be sorted out on an ongoing basis through an extension to the grocery code adjudicator.
And just while I've got you here, yeah. Sustain, what's up for Sustain for the next 12 months?
The priority will be the agriculture bill, so the white paper and getting our members to collectively say what they want to see in that. And it will be from a broad perspective. We're not just conservation, we're not just public health, we're all of it. And so getting positions to DEFRA and to the consultation that reflect that broad membership will be an interesting exercise, but we've already gone some way. But we're also going to be demanding an extension to the grocery code adjudicator, and we'll be demanding action for agricultural workers. We don't hear much about agricultural workers. There's hundreds of thousands of them. They need to be better protected because we know there's a lot of abuse, which is partly reflecting the fact that farming system doesn't get a fair deal in the marketplace. So workers need to be able to demand a decent condition and a decent wage, but it needs to be reflected by decent prices and at the farm gate. Doesn't necessarily mean high prices for consumers who may be struggling, but farmers need to get a decent deal.
There are many sessions at the ORFC that focus on biodiversity and the state of nature as much as agriculture. And one of these, chaired by writer Sarah Woods and involving Dave Gulson from the University of Sussex and David MacDonald from the University of Oxford, questioned what is happening to the world's insects, especially in the light of a landmark German study published last year which recorded insect abundance across a large number of German nature reserves. Here's Dave Gulson talking about that study.
This story got a lot of coverage a few months ago when it was published. I was sort of dragged in to help analyse and write in English this study that was performed by a bunch of amateur German entomologists over the last 20 odd years, where they'd essentially just been sampling flying insect abundance with a thing called malaise traps, which have a bit like a tent, and flying insects just bash into them and then tend to walk backwards and throw into a pond of alcohol. These guys have been doing this since the late 1980s, all over Germany, and ended up with this really dramatic data set, which I guess they never had any idea what they were going to find when they did this. And they're, I think, they're largely doing the trapping out of personal interest in what interesting bugs they might find. But the long and short of it is that if you weigh the daily catch of insects and look at how it's changed between 1989 and 2014, it's dropped by 76%. So the weight of flying insects buzzing through the air has reduced by a little over three quarters in a 26-year period, right across Germany. We don't know for sure whether you'd have the same pattern if someone had been malaise trapping here, because nobody was malaise trapping here. But Germany is broadly similar in terms of the landscape and the way they farm and so on. And it tallies with the other data we have for butterflies and moths and so on from the UK. And it's pretty terrifying. A lot of people don't much care about insects, and I gave a radio interview about this study to a Canadian radio show, and the first question was, so the insects are all dying, that's a good thing, isn't it? Well, I didn't really know quite how to answer that. About two-thirds of all the species on Earth that we have named so far are insects, most of them flying insects. So if this German data is correct, we're rapidly losing most life on Earth. And of course that includes flying insects, includes all the pollinators. I'm sure you're all aware of how important they are to us. Roughly a third of the food we eat relies upon pollinators to produce it. And it also, the umpteen other insects that are important in recycling dung and as food for most of the animals that David studies, many bats, birds, other mammals. If we lose the insects, then they've got nothing to eat. And we've seen really dramatic declines of things like spotted flycatchers, which are specialists in feeding on aerial insects, flying insects. So it really should be a warning that something absolutely dramatic is happening. This is not going to be a problem, you know, in 50 or 100 years' time. This current rate of decline, so far as we can measure it, suggests that within a very short number of years, there'll basically be very little left of our wildlife, which is absolutely terrifying. It raises all sorts of interesting questions as to what exactly is driving it, and the study doesn't tell us that. It wasn't designed to find, it's not an experiment, it's just counting insects. It's not climate change. That's the one thing the study does rule out, because when we analysed the data, we included weather, and weather explains a lot of variation from day to day and the insects are flying about, but it doesn't explain any of the 26-year decline, because actually the climate hasn't changed that much yet. It's going to, and it probably will have all sorts of profound effects. But then that leaves us, okay, if it's not climate, what is it? Well, it brings us back to... So the way I interpret it is more based on my work on bees. With bees, it's pretty clear that their declines are due to a combination of things. It's habitat loss, there aren't any flowers anymore, or way fewer flowers than there used to be in the countryside. So there's no food for them. There aren't many places for them where they can nest undisturbed. They're affected by diseases, non-native diseases brought in with honeybees. We move honeybees around the world as domestic animals. And they're constantly exposed to a whole cocktail of pesticides, insecticides, fungicides, all sorts of things. And you stick those things together and, you know, insects may be able to cope with one stress, but if they're hungry and infected with some foreign disease and being poisoned with several different toxins all at the same time, it's probably not surprising that they're disappearing. And my guess is it's pretty much the same for all of these flying insects.
It must be said that was a fairly sobering session, but important to discuss nonetheless. The good news is that there are many farmers on all scales who are working to improve the state of nature on their farms and working with nature in mind. The Nature Friendly Farming Network has been recently established to bring together such farmers and provide a platform for them to share their knowledge, attend training and events, and champion sustainable nature-friendly farming. They chose to launch their organisation on the second day of the conference, but before that, I spoke to their chair, Martin Lines, a farmer from Cambridgeshire. I asked him first to introduce the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
It's a network of farmers throughout the UK coming together who are practising nature-friendly farming and conservation farming in all its different disguises and all different farming practices. And we're all sort of coming together to have a voice and be heard and also engage with policy.
Why did the network come together in the first place?
There's a number of farmers felt disillusioned and didn't have a voice. Some survey work was done a couple of years ago and that was highlighted, and it's been a steady progress to come to where we were. It was started last year to bring those together and form a steering group of farmers, which started in November. And we're really excited for our public launch tomorrow and shout about who we are and make farmers proud about the countryside they're delivering.
Yeah, completely. And you were launching at the Oxford Real Farming Conference.
Yep.
Why here?
It's an appropriate place to be. It's to listen and talk to like-minded other farmers and other organisations. We have a session tomorrow where we're doing a presentation about what the nature-friendly farming is. And it's just that opportunity to raise awareness of farmers working together for a better environment.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to speaking to some of your farmers in more depth. But just give me a brief idea of the breadth of your farmers who are involved.
So I'm a Cambridgeshire arable farmer. We have farmers from Shetland, Northern Ireland, Wales, Cornwall, up and down the country, all coming together from all different backgrounds of farming. So some of Cumbrian livestock farmers up on the hill, the Welsh mountains, the organic farmers. We've all come together with a common ideal that actually we can manage the countryside better, but we also need the payment and the support system to work, and that's why we're really keen to get involved with the policy side as we go forward with the new agricultural document.
Martin Lines there from the Nature Friendly Farming Network. Following the launch on the second day, I met with four farmers from across the UK who are part of the network, including Martin. We spoke about the good and the bad of formal farm conservation schemes across the UK to date.
So I'm Martin Lines, a Cambridgeshire arable farmer.
David Corrie-Close, farmer from Cumbria, native breeds of cattle in the hills.
Geraint Davis, hill farmer from Bala in North Wales.
John Carson, an organic farmer 30 miles east of Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Now, in different parts of the UK, we've got different formal conservation schemes. I'm wondering if we could reflect, say starting with Glastier, of the successes, what's been good about it, over the past 10 years, say, and what could still be improved on?
Yeah, Glastier is a hit and miss scheme in Wales, really. It's too prescriptive to start off negative. It's not accessible for a lot of farmers. You've got to earn the points to get into the scheme, and there's a lot of pockets of farmland in Wales missing out. They really want to get into these schemes, but they're just failing through a point system. But I've been lucky enough myself, I've been able to get into it, and things that have been a real success for us is regeneration of our hedgerows. We're planting stubble turnips down in early summer and grazing them and leaving the ground bare over winter. And yeah, the amount of wildlife of birds that are landing there, scratching around in early spring as well, you know, it's fantastic. There are good parts within the Glastier and there are some bad parts with it. And I think now, coming out of the European Union with Brexit ahead, I think we've got this blank canvas to make a scheme now that can work for everybody. And it's going to be important that we push on that, I think.
What about the case in Northern Ireland?
In Northern Ireland, I think we're at a really exciting time because this is a chance in a lifetime. We're preparing for the next generation coming forward. And changes that are happening now, if they're made right, is something that's going to lay down the foundations for the next 25 to 30 years. Environmental schemes have been good in the past. They seem to be getting more complicated. There seems to be more red tape involved now with a lot of these schemes, and it's putting farmers off joining. But we need to get back to simplicity again and make them less complicated for the farmer.
Of course, in England, we've had big changes over, say, the last 20-year period. We started with a countryside stewardship scheme, we moved into environmental stewardship, we had set-aside before that as well, and now we're moving into a new countryside stewardship scheme. Lots of levels, lots of ideas. What are both of your experiences of schemes in England?
I don't think there's any doubt that the money that's gone into those schemes has produced good results across the country, but I think it could be better spent. It could be, we could get better results for the same amount of spending, and we could do an awful lot more if there was more money available for those schemes as well. Certainly on land that we're involved with, HLS schemes, the landlords have been very pleased with the results that they're getting. There's an awful lot of survey work goes on the land that we're involved with, because a lot of it is designated. It's wildlife reserves. And so we're fortunate that that survey work gets done by some of the organisations that we're involved with. But we desperately need more survey work. We desperately need more case studies of all the good stuff that has gone on in the past to inform us about how we might tweak things in the future to make a better job of it.
We're now in a countryside stewardship, so a lot of people are doubtful, you know, and apprehensive of joining because of the complications and the record keeping, and also the penalties that if you do something slightly wrong, you can jeopardise all your other payment, which is a real worry to some people. And a lot of the schemes, that they need to be targeted to the species and the habitat you're trying to create, not do just a general prescriptive scheme. And sort of, it's got to be well delivered. Some of the schemes in the previous options were never actually delivered very well by the farmer. They were there, but they didn't actually do the thing they were meant to do. But I think there should be a local support, or somebody come along and help you and guide you through it. And so from the survey work and that, so you understand what you've got and where you want to go to, and then you can record it at the other end. We need to record what we're doing.
It's been suggested today that a useful thing going forward would be to put more trust back in the farmers and make them feel like they are in charge of their own destiny on their farms, and they are responsible for the great things that will go on as a result of being involved in the scheme. There are a number of examples across the UK where payment by results pilots are being rolled out, and farmers are doing some of the monitoring work for themselves and reporting back on the performance that their new ways of management are delivering.
We spoke about a lot of other issues and at length about the Nature Friendly Farming Network itself, and if you're interested, there will be a future special Meet the Farmers episode based on this longer conversation. In the meantime, if you want more information about the network, visit their website www.nffn.org.uk, where you can also find information on how to join. Whether you're a farmer or simply interested in sustainable farming or environmental protection, Martin and his team would love to hear from you. Now, the Nature Friendly Farming Network wasn't the only thing to be launched to the ORFC this year. Heritage cereals were also in the spotlight, with, for example, John Letts giving delegates a superb introduction to a range of heritage grains in his Heritage Grain Lab on the second day. John, along with baker Michael Hansen, held an informal introductory meeting at the ORFC, calling for a diversity grain alliance, which would encourage the production and use of heritage grains, from organising participatory research projects to offering practical advice to small-scale growers, baking courses and marketing advice. I spoke to John and Michael on the Friday morning, and first of all asked John to explain what is meant when we refer to heritage grains.
Heritage grain to me, and I think to most people working in the field now, implies genetic diversity, and that's what our agricultural system has missed, is genetic diversity. Modern varieties, whether you're organic or conventional, you're generally using varieties that are very genetically uniform. They've been intensively selected from, you know, hybridization and then very intensively selected to perform very well in very specific high input conditions, whereas the grains of our ancestors, heritage grains, go back 10,000 years, are very diverse and are very adaptable.
Something I was reading into what you're looking to do is actually attract a different kind of grower that actually sends a message that grains can be grown on a smaller scale.
Yeah, I think that's critical. I mean, you know, right now, farming or cereal farming is pretty much uneconomic unless you have, I don't know, 1,000 acres or 500 acres. I mean, you know, the input costs are so high. Yields might be fine, might be really high, but that doesn't mean you've got more money in your pocket. Someone's making money, but it's not necessarily the farmer. And in growing wheat in that high input way, it's costing the earth. It's unsustainable. But the overall key really is to grow crops with diversity, with genetic diversity. They're adaptable, they're resilient. I mean, you know, we're in a period of climate change where you don't know where the weather, we get all the seasons in one day, and it's getting worse. It's becoming much harder to predict how to grow things, you know, and when to do your operations. So farmers could have a more resilient and reliable crop, more sustainable, lower input costs, and a higher profit for their product at the end. That all makes sense to me as a way forward.
And Michael, today at the Oxford Real Farming Conference, you are launching the Diversity Grain Alliance. Can you tell me what that is and what you hope it to be?
Yeah, well, I've worked with John for the last 4 years, helping him with the seed and growing and baking with it. And I've seen the improvement and the vast interest amongst people who want to buy bread and bakers who want to use heritage grains. Or grains which give them a loaf which is not necessarily more interesting, but tastier. Bakers are very experimental people, and they, you know, the ones I know, they want to use more interesting flours. They have a desire to sort of push their skill. So, you know, with all this interest in the ancient grains, heritage grains, we just felt the time was right to actually sort of follow some of the examples of what's going on in America. So we're hoping that bakers, farmers, all sorts of people will come along. You know, we want to set something up which is akin to the Land Workers Alliance, really. So it's going to be a not-for-profit, and we're hoping that everyone's enthusiasm will create a UK Grain Alliance that'll have legs.
In terms of policy, what is holding heritage grains back?
I think one of the issues is the legislation. We have what's called the National List of Permitted Varieties. It is actually illegal in all EU countries, and the British government has already said they would carry this into post-Brexit period, is that it's illegal to transfer ownership of any genetic resource. So even these older varieties, even though they're, you know, superbly more adapted in a period of climate change for organic farming, it is illegal for me to give you that grain. And it's a, you know, criminal offence. I mean, you could eventually go to jail. There's massive fines. So, you know, the system criminalizes the diversity of our ancestors that has actually allowed us to evolve here as a civilization and to survive. And that seems ridiculous to me. We need that diversity for the future. But how do you transfer that legally? That's, I think, a critical issue. That's why I think having a grain alliance that as a group could, in a participative way, develop group-owned, you know, very genetically diverse population that could adapt to different parts of the UK would be a fantastic way forward. It might just well skirt through the legislation. And that legislation is probably going to be tightened in a post-Brexit period, because I think the GM crops and end crops that have been produced in ways similar to GM are going to start to come in, and they're going to start to enforce that legislation. I think there are ways through that, but I think that's one of the critical things. There's also probably that conservatism in the farming sector, which, you know, I fully understand coming from farming roots myself, that, you know, you grow things one way for generations and you're always trying to push for maximum yield. And, you know, you really do want to produce a high quality crop to feed people, but you're given a handful of modern varieties to grow. You're told how to grow them by your agronomist. You know, you're looking for a, you know, 0.2% higher increase in yield. There's a lot of momentum to continue in that system. So I think accepting that you might get half or a third of the yield is difficult for a farmer to accept, because they see that as a failure. But actually, if you're getting a higher profit in your pocket and you're producing higher quality food, I mean, we can produce top quality grain in the UK. We have the longest growing season almost anywhere, and we produce the highest yields of really good tasty grain, but it's not sustainable. We can't continue on the path we're on. So the legislation, the policies, whatever government's in, have to look at this in a much broader way. We're not just, you know, feeding the industrial grain market. We shouldn't be. We've got to diversify. People, you know, people could come to Britain as tourists, they go to the countryside to buy some traditional local cob loaf that's made using local grains, just like they're going to buy a local beer or a local gin. That's where the market should go, and hopefully the government would have legislation that would encourage that.
Michael Gove was talking. That was, you know, one of the main thrusts of his argument, that he said several times he wanted the UK to be at the top end of food standards and quality. Mm. And, you know, bread is the crucial thing. It's the big thing that everyone wants.
We need to rebuild local grain economies. That's what people talk about. So, you know, my vision is to grow locally. I have a number of farmers growing these very genetically diverse, very sustainable, very hardy and adaptable crops that will go through any weather. They might vary a little bit from season to season, but that's just terroir. You know, that just adds flavor and locality to it. So you're using those local grains, supplying local mills, so creating massive employment, by the way, in a legislation sense. That's what we want. So all that could work together to create a rebuild what was the traditional way of doing things in the past. Now, you know, that might not help the corporate shareholders, but it's going to help the environment, it's going to help people's health. It's actually a sustainable way of doing things. So working together, it's viable, it works. But with a bit of science, with modern technology, with a bit of insight and people working together, we can actually recreate a viable, you know, healthy, high employment, local grain economy that works.
They're doing it in America, they're doing it in France, you know, and in Europe. You know, we've got to take the opportunity.
As I said at the beginning of this podcast, there was so much going on at the conference, and I've only been able to draw out a few of the strands for you. However, in summary, I would say that the event was full to the brim with what I would call reserved optimism. Whilst farming as a whole still doesn't really fit the model that delegates of the RFC have been calling for, the momentum seems to be going their way, and moves are being made both on a farm level and on a national political level to move to a system that has sustainable policy and practice at its heart. It's going to take time, but clearly the next few years are going to see radical change in our farming systems. I have no doubt that the RFC and those that attend this flagship event will continue with their movement calling for a more sustainable farming system and will no doubt achieve much of what they wish to happen. However, it's important that other farmers who weren't at this particular conference or who were down the road at the Oxford Farming Conference this week aren't alienated. It's about learning from each other and moving forward together. To finish, I asked a few delegates at the RFC what they would take away from this conference or whether they had a favourite session.
The landscape is just sort of incredibly different.
Apart from the sessions themselves, which have been excellent, it's the edge time. You know, the conversations in between. So contacts and experience sharing, what's not worked, or working or not working.
You've been here before?
Yeah, last year was my first year, and I'm going to become a life member. It's how it needs to go, and let's increase the noise, you know.
Really empowering time just to network and meet with so many like-minded people. Going away, it's great to hear there's momentum in the small abattoir discussion and how there's actual plans being put in place to make this actually become a reality, and just hope that it gets pushed through.
The most fantastic thing about this conference is it gives you energy to carry on the work. It makes you remember that you're not the only one. And it really does fire you up for the rest of the year, because there's so many people thinking logically about sustainable food production, about building soil, about helping our communities help themselves. So it has been an absolutely momentous experience, and I'll be coming back until I'm in my dotage, basically.
That's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. And if you enjoyed it and would like to listen to future Meet the Farmers podcasts, or indeed read articles on Thinking Country, give the blog a follow by visiting thinkingcountry.com/blog. I look forward to hearing from you soon. Many thanks to everyone at the RFC for everything you did to make this year's conference such a success. Thank you, Nessie, for your brilliant leadership and enthusiasm. The rest of the leadership team, including Claire Horrell, Hannah Fenton, and Catherine Mansell, who did an amazing job behind the scenes in the press room. All the speakers, all those who provided delicious, sustainably sourced food, of course Colin Tudge and Ruth West for your continued inspiration, and the various sponsors of the event, including the Esme Fairbairn Foundation, Riverford Organic Farmers, Compassion in World Farming, the Soil Association, Innovative Farmers, Cotswold Seeds and Triodos Bank. Finally, thank you everybody who attended the conference, and especially those who took the time to speak to me during the 2 days there. I look forward to seeing you all again next year.